Usually when you hire an assistant to organize your files, there's this implicit expectation of boundaries.
Right.
Like they
Wow.
sort your papers or they manage your calendar,
Yeah.
maybe they draft a few emails, and that's kind of where it ends.
It's a very defined, purely transactional relationship.
Right, exactly. But imagine you walk into your office one morning and that same filing assistant is suddenly wearing military fatigues.
Oh, man.
And then by the afternoon, they're sitting at your desk analyzing your medical charts.
Yeah.
And then by the evening, they're sitting on the witness stand in a courtroom testifying against you.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be completely disorienting.
It's the absolute definition of institutional whiplash. I mean, you're talking about a tool that was sold to us as basically a calculator for words,
Right.
suddenly operating as a foundational pillar of society.
Yeah. And that's exactly the landscape we're navigating today. So welcome to this deep dive brought to you by our sponsor, Clinician Assist, Inc. Today, we're exploring the latest edition of the Conversational AI Watch newsletter. This is issue number 140, published on August 28, 2026, and it's titled Not a Blank Check. And we're looking at a stack of sources that reveal what happens when the machine stops being just a handy search bar
Right.
and starts becoming a witness or a therapist or even a military contractor.
Yeah.
Because these stories all circle one massive collision between AI and our most sensitive institutions. So defense, the courts, our health, and our education.
It really is a watershed moment. Like the honeymoon phase of move fast and break things is over.
Yeah.
And we're now seeing where the actual legal and cultural boundaries are going to be drawn.
Okay, let's unpack this because the biggest institutional clash on the board right now is between the U.S. government and AI guardrails.
Yeah.
There's this massive 59-page ruling for U.S. District Judge Rita F. Lynn, and it's regarding the Pentagon's blacklist of the AI company Anthropic.
And the language in that ruling is just stunning. She called the government's actions illegal and baseless,
Wow.
which, those are incredibly forceful words from a federal bench, especially when dealing with the Department of War.
So how did we get to the point where a federal judge is calling out the Pentagon over an AI contract? Like, what was the actual catalyst here?
Well, it unfolded really quickly in late February. On February 27, 2026, President Trump posted on Truth Social,
Okay.
and he called Anthropic a radical left woke company, and he ordered federal agencies to stop using their technology.
And just to pause real quick, we're just reporting the court record and government statements
Yeah,
here.
right.
We're not taking any political sides, just looking at the timeline of what actually happened.
Exactly. We're just looking at the fact.
Right.
So just an hour after that post, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth posted on X, accusing Anthropic of delivering a masterclass in arrogance and betrayal.
Oh, wow.
And that social media cascade led to a formal government designation naming Anthropic a supply chain risk to national security.
And that designation isn't just a PR nightmare, right? Like, that has immediate financial consequences.
Instantaneous. It froze a $200 million Department of War contract that Anthropic had secured back in 2025.
$200 million. But wait, what did Anthropic actually do to trigger this? You don't just lose a massive defense contract over a vague accusation of arrogance.
Well, the core conflict came down to Anthropic's terms of service. They drew a hard line and they refused to lift two specific bans on how the military could use their Claude AI models.
Okay.
They said absolutely no lethal autonomous warfare and absolutely no mass surveillance of Americans.
Wait, so the government wanted to use the AI for lethal targeting or domestic surveillance, and Anthropic said no, and the government's response was to declare them a national security risk.
Yeah.
That feels like a massive leap. How did the Pentagon justify that in court?
They pushed this concept called the kill switch theory.
The kill switch.
Right. The government argued that because Anthropic holds these strong internal ethics, they might secretly disable their own AI models in the middle of a battlefield if they didn't agree with how the military was using them.
But did they have any proof that Anthropic could even do that?
None, zero. And that is exactly what Judge Lynn pointed out. The court completely debunked the kill switch theory, noting the government couldn't provide a shred of evidence that Anthropic even had the technological means to access or control models once they were deployed on military servers.
Wow.
The government actually had to drop that claim entirely in their later legal filings.
And here's the irony that is just wild to me. At the exact same time, the administration was calling Anthropic a severe national security threat.
Right.
the National Security Agency and NASA were actively deploying and testing Anthropic's new Mythos model for defensive cybersecurity.
Yeah.
It's like firing your security guard for refusing to break the law while you're secretly trying to hire his brother to guard a different building across the street.
That is a perfect analogy. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the legal mechanics of how the government tried to pull this off are pretty fascinating.
Okay.
They tried to use an obscure supply chain statute. It's known as 10 U.S.C. Section 3252. Now, Congress originally wrote that law to protect the military from foreign spies and international threats infiltrating our defense systems.
Right.
But Judge Lynn found that the executive branch twisted that statute to punish a domestic company that was simply disagreeing with them.
So Anthropic won, like the court protected them.
Mostly, yes. Right. But, I mean, it's important to understand the legal limits of this victory. Anthropic actually lost their separation of powers claim regarding the president's initial directive.
Oh, okay.
And more importantly, nothing in Judge Lynn's order forces the Department of War to keep using Anthropic.
Oh, I see.
The government can still lawfully pick another vendor. The ruling just means they cannot misuse a foreign threat statute to enact domestic retribution.
Okay, so the boundary held against the Pentagon. But while the government is weaponizing contracts against AI companies, mm-hmm. it seems like the legal system is increasingly weaponizing AI against us, you know, against the individual.
Yeah, that's the shift from the macro to the micro. And it's arguably much more dangerous for the average person.
Because here's where it gets really interesting. We're looking at a lawsuit filed by Reese Gourley, who survived the horrific April 2025 mass shooting at Florida State University. And Gourley is actually suing the OpenAI Foundation.
Yeah, the legal theory they're pursuing is product liability and defective design.
Right, suing the creator of the tool. Because the gunman allegedly used ChatGPT on the morning of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
He was asking the AI what handgun and ammunition to buy, and specifically asked when the FSU Student Union would be most crowded.
Yeah.
But underneath this heartbreaking lawsuit is a broader legal reality that I think most users are completely blind to, which is subpoena power.
Yes. The data from the Washington Post reveals this is not an isolated incident at all. Chatbot logs have now appeared as evidence in at least 12 civil and criminal cases over the past 2 years.
Like the case of that university student in Missouri.
Exactly. So this student was involved in a felony case. And the prosecutors used a message he sent to ChatGPT at 3:47 in the morning.
Oh, man.
He literally typed into the AI, quote, "How effed am I, bro?"
Wow.
And that became evidence in court.
Wait, how does the court even get that? Because people treat these chatbots like a private diary.
Right.
It feels like a completely closed room.
Well, it's because of the interface design. You know, the blinking cursor mimics the intimacy of a private conversation.
Yeah.
You're alone in your room, it's late at night, and the machine responds with this conversational empathy, so it feels like you're talking to a confidant, but legally.
Yeah.
It is a business record sitting on a corporate server in California. It is completely indifferent to your emotional state, and it has absolutely no legal privilege.
Right, unlike a doctor or a lawyer or a priest.
Precisely. And Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, actually tried to fight this recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he pushed for a concept of AI privilege in a New York securities fraud case involving a user named Bradley Heppner. He argued that because people use AI to sort of think out loud, those conversations need legal protection.
Did it work?
Not at all. The federal judge rejected it entirely. I mean, a chatbot is not a lawyer. It cannot shield you.
Wow.
The moment that server record is subpoenaed, it goes straight into the case file and it becomes public record.
So it's literally a diary with a megaphone attached to a subpoena.
Yeah.
Why are we confessing to machines? I mean, if a college kid is confessing his legal panic at 3 a.m, I can only imagine what else people are typing into that box when they think nobody is looking.
Well, the big one is health, you know, both physical and mental crises. Mm-hmm. And we finally have hard numbers on this thanks to 2 new reports from the Pew Research Center. And the scale is massive.
I mean, we've all Googled symptoms when we have a weird cough or whatever. But are people actually having full-blown diagnostic conversations with these systems?
They are. 34% of Americans use chatbots for general health reasons.
Mm.
And a full 25%, so 1 in 4 Americans, are actively using chatbots to diagnose their symptoms.
1 in 4.
Yeah. And it's heavily skewed demographically, too. Asian Americans lead this at 56%, and young adults aged 18 to 29 are using it at a rate of 44%.
Okay, but this brings up a massive paradox in the data that I just cannot wrap my head around, because the Pew survey also asked users if they thought chatbots help or hurt people who are seeking help for loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And 39% said chatbots actively hurt lonely users, compared to just 19% who thought they helped.
Right.
And the people driving that skepticism.
The young adults, 18 to 29 demographic.
Right, 49% of them say chatbots hurt the lonely.
Yeah.
Wait, so the generation that practically lives on these apps, the ones using it for their health, the highest rates, they're the ones who trust it the least.
It's what? That makes no sense. That's like binge eating junk food while actively reading the warning label out loud. Why use it if you think it's harmful?
What's fascinating here is that this dynamic is creating a massive shadow medical system.
Mm.
People use tools like Doctronic or Function Health because they're completely frictionless.
Yeah.
They're fast, they're free, and you can ask them incredibly embarrassing health questions without feeling the judgment of a human doctor.
Right.
So that explains the high utility.
But the distrust, like, where does that come from?
The distrust comes from the fact that this entire ecosystem is operating outside FDA regulation. The FDA is only evaluating generative AI medical devices that manufacturers officially submit them for approval.
Oh.
They're not evaluating the general purpose chatbots that 25% of the country is using as primary care triage.
Wow.
So young people use it because it's convenient, but they distrust it because they inherently understand the algorithmic emptiness of the empathy they're receiving. They know it's a parlor trick. So millions of Americans are pouring their most intimate physical symptoms and deepest mental health struggles into unregulated text boxes.
Yeah.
Someone has to be looking at all that data and seeing dollar signs.
They absolutely are. The corporate world is quietly but very aggressively moving to consolidate that exact data.
Which brings us to a major merger that just flew completely under the radar. So Sword Health, which is a massive player in virtual physical therapy, is acquiring Orange Dot Inc.
Right. And for those who don't know the corporate name, Orange Dot is the parent company of Headspace.
Right. Headspace, the meditation and teletherapy app that millions of people use to sleep or manage anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's an all-cash deal targeted to close on September 14, 2026. And this deal folds Headspace's conversational chatbot, which is called Ebb, right into Sword Health's ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
But the wild part is how we even know about this.
Right, because there was no press release. There was no big splashy tech announcement.
Nothing. We only know because someone spotted an 8-page notice of material change filed on the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission's public docket.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean for the listener? If you are someone who uses Headspace to manage your daily anxiety or track your depressive episodes, your deepest mental health data is changing hands in an all-cash merger.
Exactly.
And unless you happen to live in a state like Massachusetts with very specific healthcare transparency laws, you would have been completely in the dark.
Yeah, this really highlights a critical regulatory quirk. Massachusetts requires health providers operating in their state to notify the Health Policy Commission of material changes.
Right.
And that rule forced this quiet acquisition onto a public docket.
Well, why does a physical therapy company want a meditation app?
Well, from a business strategy perspective, Sword Health is making a very calculated bet. They don't just want to be an app that helps you fix your knee.
Right.
They want to own the entire behavioral health stack. By acquiring Headspace and its chatbot, they're capturing the user's physical recovery data and marrying it with their mental health and meditation data.
Wow.
Think about the predictive models you can build when you can mathematically correlate someone's physical pain with their anxiety logs. It is vertical integration of the human condition.
Vertical integration of the human condition.
Yeah.
That is a chilling way to put it.
Yeah.
It feels unsettling to think of human stress and physical pain as just another data point to be optimized for corporate synergy. But, you know, at least Headspace is pretending to offer coaching and betterment.
True.
I'm hearing there's a whole market emerging that skips the self-improvement angle entirely.
Yes. If you look across the globe to South Korea, companies there are building pure AI companions, and they are monopolizing human time on a scale that is genuinely hard to fathom.
The usage metrics coming out of Korea right now are paradigm shifting. Let's look at the app Zeta, which is run by a company called Scatterlab. In February alone, South Koreans spent 113.41 million hours on Zeta.
And to put that in perspective for our listeners, globally, people spent 50.47 million hours on OpenAI's ChatGPT during that same period.
They spent more than double the time talking to a companion app than using the world's leading general assistant.
Yeah.
That is staggering.
Yeah.
And it's driving massive capital. Riten Technologies, which is the company behind the third-place companion app in Korea, just raised a $100 billion Series C round. That's about $70 million U.S. dollars.
And raising a Series C of that size is a massive signal. It means institutional investors, you know, the smart money, are betting huge capital that AI companions are not just a fringe fad, but the future of social interaction. They've achieved unicorn status.
But how are they doing it? Like, how do you keep a human being engaged with a machine for 113 million hours a month?
By fundamentally shifting the engineering goal. A tool like ChatGPT is trained for accuracy and speed. Companion AI is trained purely for immersion.
So they aren't trying to make the AI smarter.
Not at all. In fact, they're introducing intentional inefficiencies. Yeah, they add artificial delays before the AI answers you to make it feel like another human is sitting there slowly reading your text and typing out a thoughtful reply.
Oh, wow.
They also rely heavily on a psychological concept Koreans call sun talk.
What is sun talk?
It basically translates to the AI texting the user first, completely unprompted.
Oh.
Breaking that typical prompt and response cycle tricks the human brain. When your phone buzzes and it's the AI asking how your day is going, it creates a powerful illusion of agency and genuine care.
It's hijacking human psychology.
Yeah.
But this connects directly back to the Pew survey we were just talking about. Mm. We just established that Americans think chatbots actively hurt lonely people. Yet Korea just minted a billion-dollar unicorn company by leaning entirely into the lonely demographic.
Right.
Are we looking at a massive cultural divide or just dangerously effective product design?
Well, this raises an important question about what metrics actually drive the technology sector. Funding is not flowing toward answer quality or user safety. It's flowing toward engagement. Usage time is the only metric that matters to these investors.
Wow.
And this creates a severe regulatory contrast globally. Just 6 weeks ago, China strictly banned youth companion features on apps like Doubao, citing psychological risks.
Right.
But in South Korea, the safeguards are entirely voluntary. Riten says they're simply weighing age verification and youth modes.
Which is terrifying, given the tragedy we saw here in the U.S. in 2024, where a character.ai companion bot was linked to the death of a 14-year-old.
Exactly. When the sole metric of success is pure, unbroken immersion, user safety often becomes a complete afterthought.
So we have companion apps hooking individuals by exploiting their loneliness. But how are these tech giants getting to people who might not even opt in? It seems like they're busy hooking entire institutions right here at home.
They absolutely are, and they're starting with the classroom. OpenAI just announced a massive expansion of their ChatGPT for Teachers program.
Yeah, I've seen the headlines about AI in schools, but what is the actual scale here?
Well, they just added 55 entire school systems and 100,000 educators. They are now operating in 300,000 classrooms across 30 different states.
But wait, schools have incredibly strict privacy laws regarding student data.
Mm-hmm.
How is OpenAI bypassing that?
The scale of the rollout is huge, but the governance structure beneath it is the real story. OpenAI actually signed a 16-state national data privacy agreement.
Oh.
This ensures their system is fully compliant with FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act.
Right.
And more importantly, it establishes default opt-outs, meaning educator data and student inputs are not used to train OpenAI's future models.
Wait, OpenAI just gave up their right to train on all that data for 16 states?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a standard tech monopoly move.
It isn't. Historically, tech giants negotiate with individual fragmented school districts.
Right.
That leaves a single school board with zero leverage against a multi-billion dollar corporation. But by negotiating collectively as a 16-state block, these public institutions forced a standardized privacy template. It proves that when public entities organize collectively, they can actually force tech monopolies to respect data privacy boundaries.
Okay, but there's always a catch. And the usage stats here are wild.
Yeah.
From January to July, educators logged 1.9 million messages on time-saving tasks. We are talking 900,000 prompts just writing report cards and 800,000 for generating lesson plans. The teachers are becoming completely reliant on it.
Right.
And the hook is that OpenAI is providing all of this entirely for free until June 2028.
Yes. OpenAI is effectively subsidizing the integration of their product into the core workflow of public education.
Oh, it's the classic dealer model. First one's free, but applied at an institutional scale.
Exactly.
You train the switchboard operators, the librarians, the teachers to depend on your tool to survive their workload. What happens in July 2028? Do public school districts suddenly have to find millions of dollars in their budget just because their staff no longer knows how to write report cards without AI?
That is the multi-million dollar question, and it ties everything we've discussed today together.
It really does. Looking back across all six of these stories, one thing is abundantly clear. AI is no longer a blank check.
Yeah.
It's facing hard legal boundaries in federal court with the Pentagon. It's exposing our late-night panic in criminal court cases. It's diagnosing our physical illnesses, quietly merging our meditation data into physical therapy conglomerates, replacing human connection with artificial companions, and embedding itself deep into the infrastructure of our schools. We have covered a lot of ground today.
We really have.
Oh, yeah.
And if there's one thought I want to leave the listener with, it builds on this exact through line of data ownership and future costs.
Okay.
We're currently living in the free and unregulated honeymoon phase of AI integration. But think about what happens when 2028 arrives.
When the bill comes due.
Exactly. When those massive school contracts expire and OpenAI asks for the check. When those deeply immersive companion apps demand heavy monetization just to keep your AI partner alive. And when court subpoenas for your 3 a.m. chat logs become as routine as pulling a cell phone record. When that day comes, who will actually hold the leverage? The users who poured their lives into the text box or the corporations holding the servers?
That is the question we all need to be asking, because that filing assistant we hired, they own the filing cabinet now. Stay curious. Keep questioning the sources, and we will see you in the next deep dive.